This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast discusses distressing topics involving murder. Listener discretion is advised. Also, a reminder that everyone named in this podcast is to be assumed innocent until proven otherwise in a court of law. On the last episode of Guilt.
And they were side by side, really close, just standing there looking out. And I don't know if it was at a time, it definitely wasn't her husband, because I remember her husband, because of their hair, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, I felt sick to this day. But I did go to the police 20 years later, and I kind of felt fobbed off by them. Sadly, 100% it was her.
Basically, I come across the car probably just after that guy had been killed. Camera equipment was on the back seat. It was sitting there like somebody, the keys were in the ignition.
Oh, the keys were in it?
The keys were in the car, yeah. I think I was being watched.
And he would just search for years, walking all the tracks, going off the tracks. It could just consume them.
I was the last one that probably ever saw them alive, and I've never told anybody.
They've obviously been digging, and I've just pulled a bone out. There's a piece of bone right here.
From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt. We've been on a hell of a journey in this season of Guilt. But before we start on these final four episodes, I want to thank you for all your support. In terms of downloads, it's by far the biggest season yet, and has truly cemented Guilt as a podcast to be reckoned with in Australasia. And with this comes the ability for me to use this platform to spread the word about these cases, and truly, truly make a difference. And each and every one of you listening and subscribing are a part of that. It really is you that makes this possible. Due to the importance of the witness testimony included in this and the remaining episodes, I've decided to release episodes 12 to 15 at the same time today on September 18th, 2023. So they are available right now for subscribers of the podcast. You can access the remaining episodes and what I believe is one of the most important developments in New Zealand criminal history by clicking subscribe on Apple Podcasts through your app, or for non-Apple users, you can subscribe via Acast Plus. You'll find the link in the description of this episode. For non-subscribers, the remaining episodes will be released free every Monday, as usual. Okay, now let's get into it.
Okay, it is 4:30 horrible day, windy, rainy, just rough, super windy. And I've just jumped in the car, and I feel like I keep saying this or thinking this, but I'm heading to what could be the biggest interview of my podcast career. You know, not so long ago I spoke to Barry, and he said to me that he was the last person to see Heidi and Urban alive. Well, now I'm heading to an interview of someone else who says that no, he was. And based on what he's told me briefly on the phone, that could be the case. Barry's sighting could have happened in the minutes and hours before this sighting. But the difference is, this sighting is much more detailed, and this guy tells me that he knows who killed Heidi and Urban, and he's going to tell me all about it. You know, it's crazy stuff, and I don't really know what to make of it yet. I only spoke to him for about 5 minutes on the phone. But yeah, here we go, down the rabbit hole again. But the thing is, this guy does have a connection to this case. He's not just a random person off the street that had a dream. And you're about to hear that.
Yeah, I'm Darren Old. Yeah, 1989, I was, I think I just come back from Motueka.
Yeah.
I've been down there fruit picking and came back into Waimata. My mother currently lived here at that time.
You've heard from Darren Old before, but this time, we're talking about something much more serious. What he's come forward to tell me could quite simply be one of the most important pieces of witness testimony in New Zealand criminal history. When we sit down to speak about what he saw, he's nervous. A change in the supremely confident man I spoke to on the phone. This is the real deal. And the implications are massive.
And during this time of 1989, I called into the Turner Farm on the Waimata Road, where I seen these Swedish tourists in the company of David Turner. At the time, David and James Turner,
yep,
and Donald Turner were present there, taking the number plate off a Whitesboro station wagon, where there were two Whitesboro station wagons present, and Donald had the back number plate off one of those. Yeah, I went to that house that day to score some pot. We used to get pot from there. And while I was up there, this is what I seen, was Urban and Heidi Parker in the presence of David James and Donald Turner. Donald, when I drove up there, was taking number plates off a Whitesboro station wagon. And David had Heidi Parkinson by the elbow, just coming out of the batch, 2 or 3 metres out of the batch, had her by the elbow. I looked right at her from 3 or 4 metres away. She looked petrified. Dave carried on walking to the main house, and I carried on inside, walk up the steps to the batch. And there was James and Urban Hoglund, the redhead, was sitting in the corner of that room, looking at the ground. I was none aware of who these people were until 2 years later, in 91, approximately October 91. Me and my friend Jamie Corbin were hunting up out of Whangamata, 6 kilometres off the main road of Whangamata in the Parakawai Valley area, when we came out at night time taking a shortcut and stumbled across a body which we now believe to be that of Urban Hoglund, up in the back lawn off the farm where I'd seen these two people alive 2 years prior to that.
So when you found that body, obviously you come in and we've already spoken with you and Jamie up there. So then the bit we didn't talk about in that episode was what happened then. So, you know, at that point, I think the word gets out that you guys have found the body. Thing, you guys are up there with the cops. Then they drag you in. Tell me about that process of when they brought you guys in and what happened.
Yeah, the scenario back at the police station where we were taken in for into the police station for questioning and that, and I started to tell the police officers involved in this case about what I'd seen on this farm where the body was found just behind, and the police's reply was, "We don't want to know, we have our man." So at that stage, they didn't want to know about any information coming forward, any new information coming forward. They were quite adamant that, you know, they had the case sewn up, so we didn't say any more.
Right now, your mind is probably racing. And so it should be. And I won't take you away from this interview for long. But let's just make sure you're 100% clear on the location of this sighting. We've spoken a lot about Parakawai and the forest where Urban's body was discovered by Darren and Jamie in 1991. What we haven't spoken about is the property that runs right up to that forest. Today, as it was then, this farm is owned by the local Taikato family. It runs in a long block from the main road into Whangamata all the way back, running adjacent to Parakawai Quarry Road until it eventually butts with the forest where Urban's body was discovered. In 1989, all of this area was basically just farmland. There were no houses like today. But at the top of this farm, near the main road, was the Taikato homestead. And it was here that Darren alleges he drove in one day in April of 1989 and saw Heidi Parkinen, petrified, being held by David Turner and Urban Hoglan with his head down in the corner of the cabin while James Turner stood over him. Outside, the third brother, Donald Turner, was changing the license plates on what he believes were two matching white Subaru station wagons. The distance from this house to Barry's sighting, 470 metres. The distance from this house to where Urban's body would be discovered, 2.8 kilometres.
So just to be clear, so they've brought you into the police station.
Yeah.
You know, naturally they're going to question you guys, you found the body, they bring you in. And... you know, at that point, you sort of, did you come in and they showed you photos and you realised, like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And I think you've said to me before, it sort of like suddenly it clicked it when you were showing those photos that what you saw those couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so is that about right, what happened?
Yeah, that's right. Like, when we got in there and seen all these photos and that, the penny dropped, that these are clearly the people that I'd seen at the Taikato farm in the presence of Donald James and Dave Turner at that time.
And when, after you saw Heidi and Urban that day with the brothers, so that was obviously April 89.
Yeah.
In that couple of years before you found the body, were you aware of the case of the Swedes and what was going on and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, no, nothing. I wasn't really aware of the Swedish case until, wasn't brought to my attention until I found the body. Like, we weren't aware of it. It's as simple as that, you know. We're quite a pretty quiet town here in Whangamata. We just simply weren't aware of it.
It's hard for people to understand, but, you know, Whangamata, it's a bit bigger now, but back then it was a lot smaller. I mean, it's like, in a way, you were kind of like, you were bush guys, really, eh? Like,
yeah.
There's no internet, there's no...
there's no nothing, you know. We had was rugby field in the ocean, in the bush. Those were our... that's all we had here in Whangamata. Yeah.
Describe when you...
when you came in that day, you know, you go to pick up some weed. So you come into the driveway and like, yeah, what was the order, how it went? You got out of the car.
Yeah, I just drove up the driveway, going onto the Taikato old homestead to Pat's place. Drove up there, pulled up, the two white Subaru station wagons were slightly to the left of me, both noses facing the house. And Donald was standing there, had taken the number plate off one of them, the one closest to me. That was all I saw, and when I asked him what he's doing, he goes, I'm doing an insurance job for Gary Spinks. So I didn't think any much more of it, you know, it was a common thing back in those days.
And then so then you're going to go up to, so at the main house there's a house and then there's sort of like a cabin to the side.
Yeah, there's a batch in the cabin, and that's where the boys were. I didn't get into the main house. That was Pat Taikato's house, and
Well, who would you normally buy the weed off?
I'd normally buy the weed off either Don or Dave or James, one of the boys.
Oh, just one of them. Okay, so then you're walking up to the cabin, and just as you go to get up, did you say Dave comes out?
Yeah, Dave came out. Like, I must have spooked them. Like, it was a metal driveway. So what I got a little bit of a jump on me. They were a bit coming up the metal driveway. So as I got out of my car, Dave's coming out of the batch, and Donald's right there. And Dave had the Heidi Parker him by the elbow, and she's looking really scared. Like, I looked at her from 3 or 4 metres away, and she looked petrified. I was being none the aware, you know, I was none the wiser at the time to who that was at that time, because it wasn't brought to my attention back then, you know, it wasn't.
How old were you at that time?
I was approximately 18, 19 years old.
And how old were David time. And James, roughly?
James and Dave would have been a good solid 10 years older than me, easy, yeah.
Yeah. And they were pretty well known as scary motherfuckers.
Yeah, we all got knowledge in the town.
So then you see Heidi there. And when you said she looked petrified, like, did it look like whatever's happening had already been happening for a while, or?
Yeah, I just recall the look on her face, you know, when I looked at her, it was like she was petrified, like she'd just seen a ghost or something, you know, like she was scared, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then when you go in, and did you say, like, Urban's in the corner?
Yeah, Urban's over in the right-hand corner, and he was just looking at the ground, just sitting there, like, when he was sitting on, like, a nail box or some type of box like that, just looking at the ground. He didn't look at me, which I thought was unusual. Yeah, I was a little bit curious because of the way Dave was, like how he just walked away and he had that girl by the elbow. And then when I walked in there, James was just sitting there just looking at me, and I was like, oh, bro, you got any dick? And he's like, yeah. And
Yeah. Because of who these people were, there's going to be people that are going to say, why didn't you go to the police?
Yeah.
What would be your response to that?
Well, I wasn't aware there was anything wrong at the time. You know, like, I simply, it wasn't as though the sheriff was screaming at me, yelling at me for help. Like, had that off happened, well, then it would have been a different scenario, you know?
Yeah.
Which sometimes I don't know why she wasn't screaming, you know?
She might have been worried that maybe because her barn was in there, and then she might be thinking, hey, if I just go along with this, everything will.
Maybe, like. Those were the only three people I seen there that day. It was just those three, you know, like.
Yeah.
The two white Subaru station wagons were there, so I can't say who was in the house. I don't know who was in Pat's house, but that was sort of sacred area, you know, Pat's house. You didn't go there. You didn't, you know, you went to his door, and that was it with Pat, you know.
So in terms of the ID of the two, so can you remember quite well that the girl you saw that day and the guy?
What
did Heidi look like to your memory?
Well, she was quite a pretty chick, like, for a blonde. Was red cheeks, you know. She would have been about She wasn't far away from like Dave's height, you know, from the height of what Dave was. It was around about the same height sort of thing. Urban, I couldn't say because all I remember was his gold hair, like just looking at the floor, like with his, that thick hair, you know, with a slim build.
Did he sort of just look like that kind of look?
Yeah, he was he was just looking at the floor. I don't know, he must have been told just to look at the floor, you know. I don't know what he was told, like.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite unusual that when I entered the room, I mean, as anyone enters the room, you always look at them, you know, whereas he was just straight looking at the floor from the time I went in to the time I left, which was, you know.
You could, yeah. I suppose if you imagine whatever's happening in that room, your car's suddenly driven in.
Yeah.
Fuck, you could be anyone, so it's like you shut your fucking mouth.
Yeah.
Is that what it sort of seemed like?
Well, yeah, it could have been, yeah, would have been, I'd say it.
Yeah. How does it feel like, you know, I suppose when you realised, fuck, like a couple of years later and you thought back about this, I mean, when the police brought you and Jamie in after you found the body and they questioned you, and at one point you told me they were even trying to pin it on you guys or something, you know?
Yeah, they were asking like, you know, where were you at this time, blah, 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 you know?
Yeah.
They already did their investigations and they would have rang around, you know. And
yeah. But then,
yeah,
so
we're not murderers.
So you started to tell them about what you'd seen?
Yeah.
Did they just cut you straight
off?
Yeah,
just cut me straight off. Like, I started telling them that, hey, you fellas probably got the wrong fellas because I seen these two here in this photo when here.
Yeah.
You know, right at the beginning of this farm. And then funny how that one of them ends up at the back of the farm dead. Bit of a coincidence.
And then, so, in the time between then and now, have you ever tried to go to the police and...
Yeah, over the years, I've tried to go into the police station here several times in Wangamataa to bring this to the police's knowledge, but they don't want to know. Like, no one wants to know. No one's wanted to know over the years any information about the Swedish tourist. You know, it's a closed case as far as they're concerned. Tamihiri did it, and that's that.
Let's pause for a moment to think. Imagine if the New Zealand police knew from the early 90s the truth, that there was far more to this case, and that that truth could be found not 73 kilometres away in some remote clearing in Thames, but right here in Parakawai. Only 2.8 kilometres away from where Urban's body was discovered and where Darren Lindsay saw the white Subaru on the forest track, and only 400 metres from where Barry Lindsay saw the couple driving with the Māori man. If the police had had even a suspicion, what would that mean? What would the implications of that be today? Over the remaining episodes, you're going to hear a lot about Parakawai and the Taikato Farm. Donald Turner Sr. was effectively managing the Taikato Farm and had moved a small cabin, which was referred to as the Batch, to the back of the property, in an idyllic setting next to the Otahu River. And it turns out that during this time, it was a place where a number of young men used to hang out, where they were not always, but often, up to no good.
Let's talk a bit about the... So what was your... You had a bit of a connection with... At the back of that farm, there was a batch, which was kind of like a cabin down the back.
Yeah, over the years, Don stuck a cabin out the back for the boys and for, you know, all of us homeless fellas. We used to stay there over the years. Darren Lindsay used to live out there quite permanently. He was the most permanent resident, was Darren Lindsay. And the rest of us would come and go, you know, from time to time. But Darren was always there.
Yeah. At one point, would you say that at one point you were sort of loosely friends with David Turner and James Turner?
Yeah. I did knock around with David Turner there for a period of time.
And I mean, just being upfront about yourself, I mean, you don't have a squeaky clean past.
No. I grew up here in this town and, yeah, you get a couple of bumps along the way, you know. Yeah, not the squeakiest cleaner person, but I'm not a bad person either, so,
But, so you knew these guys fairly well.
Yeah.
You sort of kicked around that property.
Yeah.
And, you know, Darren Lindsay, Prakawai Kid.
Yeah.
A bunch of people. You were telling me that you and Dave, sometime after this, you and Dave, he was wrestling with you or something in the batch.
Yeah, but Dave's a bit different. Like, he try and get you by surprise or something, you know, try and stab you or something, or wrestle you, or choke hold you or something, you know. Used to fancy himself as a brawler, and one afternoon he jumps off his bed and like he's trying to wrestle me, you know, and then I got him off. Then he said to me out of the blue, "Oh, there's two dead bodies across the creek there." And I sort of thought about it. And I thought, "Oh no, it's just Dave being crazy again." Yeah, because he's a bit unhinged, that Dave Turner.
And I suppose now, so that was sometime after you saw the Swedes there, but you still, just to be clear, you haven't connected anything at this point?
No, I didn't know nothing about it. So this was, Dave told me this prior to all this coming to light, you know, so it must have been there quite around the time that somewhere, this happened. Yeah. You know, I was right there, you know, and amongst it.
Yeah.
Somewhere of that week, I'd say.
Yeah. Tell me about... you know, so, and just to be clear, all these things we'll talk about now, they happened around this time, but you didn't know anything about the Swedes.
Nah.
But tell me about Dave picks you up one day, him and Ange.
Yeah. Dave and Ange, one day they come and see me and pick me up. We went up to Colville, straight to Colville, up the Thames Coast, to do some job Dave had in ripping off some pot up there, but when we got up there, there was clearly no pot there. There was like an old quarry face, like it was quite rocky. So I know that cannabis doesn't grow on rock. I said to Dave, "Well, where's this big patch?" And he says, "Well, the rock must have fallen over it." Well, I was not that stupid, but I went around to my left-hand side and Dave kept walking to the right, and I got up on top of this ridge probably about 20 minutes later, and as I looked down to where David walked, there's a smoke coming out of the bush fire. Like, Dave never smoked cigarettes or anything, so there's no need for him to carry a cigarette lighter. So I often think, what was he burning, you know? Like, we come all this way, he seemed to know where to stop.
In the middle of the forest.
On the middle of the side of the road, like up north of Coromandel Township, out of there somewhere. In the direction of the Colville commune, so he just knew where to stop. I just thought it was really odd back at that time, you know, like.
And so this was sometime after, because I suppose we need to be clear that when you walked in that day, picked the weed up, you've clearly caught them in the middle of something.
Yeah, walked right into the middle of a crime scene. Like,
and they knew who you were.
Yeah.
They knew you walked into that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So when you know, so the, and then this thing in Colville happens a time after that at some point.
Yeah. It was after that point, and it's always bugged me to this day, like, what was Dave Turner burning, you know, like it's a little bit odd.
And why do you think he took you up there that day?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't think he'd need me to give him a hand to rip some weed off.
Do you think that might have had a plan?
Yeah, might have been plan B or something, you know.
They might have been planning on killing you that day.
Well, I don't know Dave by himself, I don't know.
Just don't know?
Yeah, just don't know, but it was really odd. The whole thing's really odd.
Yeah.
Then when I found those Swedish tourists,
in 1991,
just after that period of time, David Turner turned up at my ex-partner's place in Auckland with my sister, which, yeah, was a bit scary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Like it was owned for me not to say anything. Like it was straight after I'd found those bodies, and my sister rings me up, Jane rang me up, and it's David Turner's here. And I thought, oh, he doesn't even know my ex-partner, so why would he go and turn up there for? I had two little kids there at the time, a baby and a girl, probably 2 years old. Yeah.
Yeah, and you think it was a... Did you feel like it was a bit intimidation?
Yeah, it was definitely intimidating, that there in itself.
According to Darren, the only people he saw at the Taiketo property that day were Heidi, Urban, Donald Turner, James Turner, and David Turner. With Heidi and Urban now dead, that leaves only one witness alive that could reveal the truth of what took place. Darren believes the day Dave took him deep into the bush near Colville, he felt something wasn't right. On arriving at the location, which was a random spot in the bush, he knew there was no marijuana plot to steal. It's an event that's deeply bothered him to this day. Did Dave Turner plan to kill Darren that day? To remove the only loose end? And what was Dave burning? Was this and Dave's appearance at Darren's sister's all part of an intimidation act to keep Darren quiet? Was their friendship the only thing that saved his life? Let's be clear about what we have at this point. We don't have Darren saying he saw the brothers kill Heidi and Urban. But at the very least, clearly they are directly involved in whatever transpired. Like I mentioned earlier, Darren Old, like Darren Lindsay, was hanging around the Parakawai area during this time. And seeing Heidi and Urban with the brothers isn't the only thing he remembers. At the back of the Taiketo property was the cabin they called the Batch. It was just a single room with a couple bunks and a mattress on the floor. It's here where they would often hang out. It's important to note that the Batch was only 300 meters down Parakawai Quarry Road from the entry to the Forest Road where Urban's body was discovered.
When you were out at that batch there, so there was just down, so by that batch there's a ford that gets across to that back block, but then there's also a concrete ford further down, and there used to be a gate there. Tell me, you said you saw that gate around that time and it was smashed in or something?
Regarding the access up to where I found Urban Hoglin, there used to be a farm gate up there, a normal farm gate steel one, just a standard one, and it had a chain wrapped around it, inch chain wrapped around it twice at one end. You couldn't cut through their chain. And at this time, during this period of time, I noticed that that gate had been rammed open, like viciously rammed open by a vehicle, which would have caused some serious damage to anything ramming it. So the gate was flattened open, obviously someone needing to get up into that block of bush in a hurry, or desperately.
Tell me about, so Darren Lindsay, that was Barry Lindsay's son.
Yeah.
And so Barry Lindsay owned all that. So the Taikato property ran all the way back pretty much up to kind of where to Irvine's body was, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then Barry Lindsay owned land around that property.
Yeah.
And his son, Darren Lindsay, he actually took residence in the bush.
Yeah, yeah. Pat Taikato owned the farm that we were living on and bordering where I found the body, and Barry Lindsay's farm was neighbouring property to the north side of the farm. And Darren Lindsay used to live on the Taikato farm. He lived there for years. After leaving school and stuff, he lived on the back of the farm for quite a period of time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Darren or Nikki, his girlfriend Nikki Tahuia, she was there for quite a few years too.
Yeah. And you said one day, so Willie Taikato as well, he used to run around there.
Willie Taikato just came over there for a period of time. He was there for, like, it might have been a summer.
Yeah.
He was there. He wasn't there at the time.
So I spoke to Darren, and he told me that he didn't steal anything out of the car.
True. Yeah, yeah.
So you tell me about what happened. You remember him coming down from up in the bush one day.
Yeah. One afternoon there, we were sitting at the beach and on the edge of the river, and Darren came down. Darren and Willie Taikato came down. I'm like, oh, I'm sure Nicky might have been there that day, eh? I'm not too sure if Nicky Tahuia was present that day. But Darren came down and he had some backpacks. He'd stolen out of a car and behind the farm and behind Taikato's farm, a White Subaru station wagon up there he broke into, and brought some backpacks down to the farm, to the batch. We pulled all that stuff out, little knickknacks and camping stuff and that.
Yeah.
And now we believe those backpacks to be the property of Urban and Heidi Parkinen, which we didn't know at the time.
So as far as you're concerned, you know, Darren did say they did break in.
They did break into the car,
And that did they... say anything about, you know, the car or anything at the time? Must have, but can you remember, I guess, is the...
Yeah, I couldn't remember any details really about the car, but then it was a White Subaru station wagon.
But, I mean, did he say about how he came across it and stuff? Like,
he said it looked suspect, like it was just a White Subaru station wagon there, you know, and...
Just sitting there. Didn't say anything about any people or anything.
Yeah, he didn't say anything to me about seeing anybody or that.
Yeah. Do you think if anything happened up in that bush there, that block, he would have known about it?
Yeah. Well, Darren was there. They did call him the Prackaway Kid, you know, and on several other occasions, people have been frightened by Darren jumping out of the bush, you know, thinking they were all alone. Next minute, this guy jumps out. What do you fellas want, you know? Yeah. So
he literally built himself a bit of a bivvy kind of...
Yeah, just, yeah, hut sort of thing. And then Don put the batch out there for us, so...
Yeah. Do you think people over the... Why do you think people haven't come forward with this story?
Yeah, I think everyone would have been too scared to come forward over the years, you know, being intimidated by these people. Was the only reason why Darren's not saying anything about this, you know, like he's intimidated. There are a lot of other locals here that know stuff about this case, you know, and no one's sort of coming forward with it for this reason. Yeah.
At this point, it's important to note that this is Darren Old's recollection of events that he witnessed, and it's his belief that Darren Lindsay, while now referred to as just Lindsay, knows more than he's saying. As you know, in the last episode, I spoke to Lindsay about him seeing the white Subaru station wagon parked near where Urban's body was found. He flatly denied to me that he ever stole anything out of the vehicle. Well, Darren Old says this is not true, because he was there, and he personally saw the gear Lindsay and Willie Taikato brought back to the badge. I'll add here that since Darren Old revealed this to me, I've had the same story confirmed by a number of people that spoke to Lindsay at the time. They all told me the same thing. Lindsay told them he did steal items from the vehicle. And if Darren is correct, and Lindsay did steal backpacks and other camping gear, then this now means I can unequivocally say that if Randall Cornish indeed did see this same gear in the back of the car on Sunday afternoon, April 9th at Tararoo Creek Road, then it simply must have driven back to Parakawai for Lindsay to steal it on the Monday prior to Tamahiti finding it. Which means someone or some people had to have been driving the car between the two locations during those days. Darren has told me that aside from the original police interview after finding the body, when he says they wouldn't listen, he's tried to go to the police a few times. And I need to note that this is something I haven't been able to confirm, and as far as I'm aware, there were no official statements taken. So what exactly these approaches were, I can't say. But there's no doubt that Darren has a drive for the truth to finally come forth, and for justice to prevail.
So you've tried to go to police over the years, like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
Why is it? What is it that's made you sort of have this drive to try and get the truth out there?
Yeah, well, I'm getting older now, so like I'm probably only one of the only few people that know what actually happened. You know, like there's obviously only a handful of us that have any real good information about it. One being my hands-on eyesighting of these two Swedes was these three brothers.
After Darren and Jamie discovered Urban's body just behind the Taikato property where the Turner brothers were staying, Darren says CIB, which is like New Zealand's FBI, interviewed Dave Turner.
I don't know. I was under the belief that I know David Turner got interviewed at that time, and then under my understanding that Bonnie Beats gave him an alibi. I think she was the one that picked him up from the police station after he was being interviewed. And then David Turner came out of the police station to Bonnie's place and then progressed to get himself a passport. Wasn't even his, and he went to America for 10 years.
Oh, for that long?
It was a few period of time.
Oh, so right after that time you found the body?
Yeah, after he bolted, like he left the country, went to America.
On a false passport?
On a false passport. Wasn't even him.
Yeah.
On the passport, and he went straight through, yeah.
In terms of, you know, dangerous people, these guys are right up the top.
The top shelf, yeah.
Yeah. Are you worried about yourself and what?
Well, yeah, there's always that worry, you know, there's always that degree of worry.
What is it that drives you to do this now? Oh, you know, put yourself in harm's?
Well, yeah, well, we've got to try and find her, and, you know, in order to find her, well, we need some more information, or, you know. Yeah.
So it's finding, it's doing the right thing, getting her home. That's your main drive.
And to try and solve what really did happen here, you know, like, yeah, obviously it didn't happen the way the police have said it's happened. That's obvious.
Yeah. How does it make, you know, when you, is it kind of burned in your mind seeing her with Dave coming out?
Yeah, like, it's etched in me, like, why was I the last person to see her alive, you know, like.
Maybe that's why, because you're the one that had the balls to come forward finally.
Yeah.
It's kind of like this responsibility's now on you sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Do you ever think about you know, about that and think, like, what could I have done? Like, could I have done anything?
Yeah, there is always that, you know, like, I should have done something back then, I should have been a bit more aware, you know. I just didn't know, you know, just straight out didn't know.
Were you scared of those guys at that time? Like,
I think everyone was, you know, like, yeah.
Can't forget you were only fucking 18.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of the people back in those days that were around that circle were dead, you know. There's only very few of us left.
And that's not from old age.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Did David, other than that day he made that comment about bodies across the thing, did he ever say anything to you about the Swedes, that he killed them or anything like that?
No, he hasn't. He hasn't directly said anything to me. I haven't directly had anything to do with them either, so, you know, I steered away from those people like years and years ago, so a long time ago. I just missed them at a funeral a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
The whole funeral was on edge when they turned up.
Yeah.
Over in Thames.
You didn't have anything to do with the Swedes and then just their murders?
No, I don't think so. It wasn't my style when I was 18.
So to your knowledge, those three, I guess the more obvious question is, did you see David Tamahere in your time when you were there?
Yeah, no, I didn't. No, I've never seen David Tamahere before. Like, I've never seen him before. Over the years, I've tried to approach his lawyer on this because I was under the... on the believing that for years and years that Tamahere was innocent, and these brothers here did this.
So you said you actually called up
Tamahere's hold of Tamahere's lawyer through the North and South magazine. There's an article in there that named his lawyer, so I got a hold of his lawyer and had a talk to him, and then was under the belief that I was actually rawly speaking to David Tamahere himself, in which I asked David Tamahere, do you know David Turner? And he said no. I said, well, that's a bit funny. We pair of yous stuck beside each other at the time of 10 yards, you'd be hard to pick the difference, you know?
According to Darren, at this time in 1989, David Turner and David Tamahere both had a very similar look. Both were part Māori, and both had beards and large moustaches, and from a distance could look very similar. Is it possible that this entire case is built around a simple mistaken identity? Or is Tamahere connected in some way? Ultimately, Darren is 100% sure of one thing, and that's what he saw that day when he drove onto that Taikato property. Donald Turner changing license plates on two white Subaru station wagons. James Turner standing beside Urban Hoglund with his head bowed in the corner of the cabin, and a petrified Heidi Parkinen being led by the elbow out of the cabin towards the house by David Turner. This is what Darren saw, nothing less and nothing more. He saw no other vehicles and no other people. It doesn't mean there weren't others around, but if there were, he didn't see them.
Yeah, I suppose, like, you know, for you personally, like, as a man, and, you know, like,
yeah,
to send her home would be fucking huge.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of, you've become the key, you're the key to this whole thing.
Yeah.
How would that feel to you, fuck, to their family, you know, to see
Yeah, well, you know, this Heidi Parker, and, you know, it could be any one of our children that this has happened to, and even all these years later, you know, to send that person home, like, to, you know, maybe not her mother and father might be gone now, but the rest of the family's still there, and just to be able to find her and to be able to put her where she belongs, you know, like, clearly their visit to New Zealand was a little bit unfortunate. But yeah, being being able to find her and that, and to take her home, it would be gold, you know, like.
Yeah. What would you say to her family, you know, if you said something directly to them?
Well, there's nothing really we can say on behalf of New Zealand, but we're sorry, you know, like, there's always a bad egg in every basket. And unfortunately, they found that bad egg. We're sorry for this, but
yeah.
We're trying our best at the moment to find this, to find your daughter, you know, and to bring her home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. No, you're doing an amazing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you're my fucking hero for doing this.
Yeah.
You know, you're really putting yourself in harm's way. And I mean, you know, the pair of us we are, but you really are.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's for the right reasons.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and just to be clear, you're not getting paid or anything to do this. This is off your own back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's awesome, Darren. Yeah, you're doing an amazing thing, man. And I think we're getting very close.
Yeah, we are.
I think we're getting very close.
I can't overstate how much respect I have for Darren for doing what he's doing. I know there are going to be those that criticize him for not doing more at the time. But as he said, he just didn't know, and he was a young man and scared of these guys like everyone else. You need to understand that back in this time, and even today, these people are living in a world different to most. They are living in the upside down, where serious drugs, assault, and even murder are commonplace. There is no love lost between this world and the authorities. And as Darren and others have told me, they have little respect or trust in the New Zealand police over how they've been treated throughout their lives. Darren admits he's lived a life that wasn't always above board. There have been a few bumps along the way, but he insists he's not a bad guy. And for those that might be quick to judge, put yourself in this position. Would you risk your life to come forward and break a case after 34 years? When a man has already been convicted and served the time for the crime. When the police have already told you they are not interested. Would you do that? I've learned so much during my time making this podcast. And the biggest thing has been never to judge a person by their past. What makes a person good? I speak to what you might call good witnesses, who due to their own, more often than not, irrational fears, refuse to speak publicly about sightings that could help this and other cases. Ironically, it's more often than not the bad people that have the courage to speak out, even knowing the risks as they do. And all too often, they're ignored because of who they are or who they were. Despite a few bumps, today, Darren is a good guy. He's got a successful business and has left that past behind. He's standing up for justice and the truth. The truth that has been hidden from all but a handful of people for the last 34 years. And most importantly, from you, the public, and the families of the victims of this horrendous crime. And in particular, Heidi's. Because as I'm writing this in September of 2023, her remains still lay out there somewhere. And as far as I'm concerned, that's for one reason alone. No one has ever looked in the right place.
A couple of days ago, we passed Queenstown. Tourists from all over are coming there. River rafting in a rubber boat is very popular, and there's a new thing you can do. You tie a rubber band around your feet, and then you throw yourself out from a 30-meter bridge. Time flies too fast here, and is coming close for us to be leaving for home. We are looking forward to some things, though. We've been living in a tent since Christmas. I can't even remember what it feels like to sleep in a bed. Urba.
Guilt is a Brevity Studios production. Written, produced and narrated by me, Ryan Wolfe. All opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that. Opinions. And are not a statement of fact by the podcast itself. All persons named are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. Voice acting in this episode, Joachim Berg as Urban. You'll find further photos and video on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ, and I highly recommend you join the discussion with thousands of other Guilt listeners on Facebook at the Guilt Podcast Discussion Group. Guilt is a 100% independent production. We've never received a single dollar in taxpayer funding, and you can support us to continue to make great content, plus get ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and early release by becoming a Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find the details in the show notes of every episode. This podcast was written and edited without the use of AI.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.